LinkedIn News.
There are things that give you a leg up when you're applying for a job. A degree from a prestigious university, for example, or academic honors on your resume. Maybe you have family connections or even just family wealth. At least historically, it helps you get your foot in the door. But if you don't have any of those things, well, it can feel like the odds are stacked against you as a job applicant, especially if the job you're applying for is in a competitive field. So, how do you get noticed? We're talking all about it on today's episode of Get Hired, right after this break.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by HubSpot. Imagine growing a business with high-quality leads, fast closing deals, and wildly happy customers. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
From LinkedIn News, this is Get Hired, a podcast for the ups and downs and the ever-changing landscape of our professional lives. I'm Andrew Seaman, LinkedIn Senior Managing Editor for Jobs and Career Development, bringing you conversations with experts who, like me, want to see you succeed at work, at home, and everywhere in between. Jim Vondehei knows what it means to make the most of what you do have. Jim's a journalist turned entrepreneur. In 2007, he launched Politico, a political news publication that redefined the journalism space. And today, he leads a team of 500 as the CEO of Axios, which he also co-founded. But back in the 80s, when Jim was in high school, he didn't seem poised for stardom at all. In fact, his grades were so low and his achievements so few that his guidance counselor told him he had, quote, zero chance of getting into college. On today's show, and in his new book, which comes out next week, Jim's sharing how he, a self-described, remarkably unremarkable guy, broke into two of the most elite industries out there and found big success in both. Here's Jim.
I'm in this interesting position, right, where I run a company. It's the second company that I've run. I ran Politico and now run Axios, both of which I helped found. But I'm also, at my core and in my past, I'm a writer. I'm a reporter. So I'm in this, I think, pretty unique position where I'm starting companies, running companies, but I'm also taking close notes about doing that. And I've hired a lot of people. I've had to get rid of a lot of people over the years. And so I've learned just a lot about leading, managing, making tough decisions, like what it takes to be successful in the workplace. And because I have that unique vantage point, it's like, I should share it. So I decided I'll pull that together into a book, mainly just to help people think a little more clearly and maybe hopefully a little more smartly about how can you have a better career? How can you be better at your job? And hopefully people will walk away and say, hey, here's 5 or 10 things that are practical that I can put to work.
Yeah. And it's super digestible and it's really easy to navigate. So I really appreciated the book. And one of the things that I want to tackle from the start is pedigree, because I think a lot of people, they sometimes say, OK, I'm born into this circumstance. It's almost like a caste system where they don't feel like they could break through to something else. And you talk a little bit about your background and not letting where you come from hold you back. Can you tell us how that has propelled you in your own life?
Yeah, it's very important to me, right? We all come to our lives with a bias. I was not a remarkable kid or a remarkable student. I graduated the bottom third of my high school class. I could barely get into college. I was on academic probation, about to get kicked out of college after my, 1.4 grade point average. So there was nothing that you'd say, oh my God, that guy's going to go found companies, cover the presidency, and be the CEO. And, I grew up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, small town, great parents, great family. When I moved out to D.C., I was just so intimidated. I just assumed everybody who went to Harvard or came from wealth or had connections in town that they were just so much better positioned than me and that I would never attain the things that they could attain because I came from this tiny town without any real connections. And that turned out not to be true. It really turned out to be like, listen, if you have confidence, if you have something you love doing, if you work exceptionally hard, if you do the right thing for the right reason, you can do as well as anybody who maybe was born with that silver spoon in their mouth or went to one of the hotshot colleges.
Yeah, resonates really with me because I grew up also in a rural town just north of Scranton. And then I went to DC for just sort of like a conference. I'm like, I think I could do this. And it was a weird eye opener, but it really helps to sort of say, okay, maybe I started there, but my aspirations don't have to end there.
And that's very similar to my life, right? It's interesting that both of us had the same experience. I grew up in a small town. I happened to do an internship in D.C. I never really left Wisconsin other than to go to Mackinac Island once and I think Chicago. Like, it's the first time I'd been anywhere. And then your eyes are opened and you're like, oh, maybe I could do this. And it's electrifying. And I think the lesson that probably both of us would pass on is, like, if you go somewhere and you see something and it tugs at your heart, like, maybe you should go do it, especially when you're young and don't really have any obligations. And in both of our cases, it worked out.
I know probably for you, it was a little bit more deliberate too, but there are a lot of people who struggle with finding out, okay, what can I do? What do I want to do? And you talk about a little bit of pursuing happiness. So for people who struggle with what they actually want to do, what would your advice be for them?
My advice is very clear, which is you should find something you would do for free. And you should be in perpetual pursuit of something you would do for free until you absolutely can no longer do it. Meaning, at some point you might get married, you might have obligations to taking care of a sick family member, and you just have to earn money to earn money. But until that moment, do what you'll do for free. And the reason is, and I'm shocked by how few people pay attention to this, but if you just break down the waking hours in a day and what you're doing, we spend 50, 60, 70, in my case, 80, 90% of our waking hours working, thinking about work, complaining about work. So why wouldn't you want to be happy or fulfilled or satisfied during those hours? And so if you can align your career with something you have genuine interest in, you're going to win the lottery. And I've always felt that way, whether I was covering the White House or whether I'm running companies. Like, I would do this for free. If I fired myself today, I would spend my weekends calling people, talking about politics, talking about how to run a company, giving people advice on maybe make this change to your product, because it's the stuff that I love doing and I love talking about it. And so I'm blessed that that happened. But I think it can happen for a lot more people if you're more purposeful about it.
Yeah. And that takes some work if you really sort of say, okay, I don't really know what I want to do. But some people, they might have to experiment a little bit, right?
Experiment. But like, how do you experiment? Do internships, do as many as you possibly can. Move around. You and I went to DC. We saw something different. It changed the course of our careers. But you have to do that. Own it, right? Like, a lot of us who grew up in smaller areas, there is a tradition of, like, you just work and you just keep your nose down and you just do the right thing and do that for 30 or 40 years. And that works for some people, but like, why wouldn't you be more purposeful about trying to do that same thing, but matching it to something you have authentic passion around? And I just think you're going to end up with a much happier life.
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard because I know when I moved to DC, it wasn't cheap to do it, to spend a summer there and not get paid for an internship. But, you know, if I was going to be poor in Pennsylvania, I might as well be poor in DC too. So.
And when you're young, you can afford to be poor. When I moved to DC, I had to stay in a group house where I paid a tiny bit of money and literally it didn't have heat. And so when I showed up in February, the room was frozen. The toilet was literally frozen. But like, I was 19, like, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. You write in the book too, something that I appreciate, which is exploiting luck, because I talk to, obviously, a lot of people about career and career trajectories, and there is this weird divide between people who say, oh, you know, you make your own luck, you know, all that stuff. But sometimes there are these things that happen that you sort of have to double down and say, okay, this is the moment that I could press ahead and really kind of get more dividends to it. So can you tell us a little bit about how you view exploiting luck?
I just think that there is a serendipity to life. Like, yes, I agree with those that say you put yourself in a position for luck, right? The more internships you do, the more people you meet, the more cities you travel to, you're giving yourself more opportunities for luck. But make no mistake, serendipity or the kindness of someone else matters as much often as your own smarts. I don't understand these people who present themselves as like the great man or the great woman, and there's just something so unique about them. Like, yes, like there's something very unique about Elon Musk. The rest of us were mere mortals. And a lot of being a mortal is that it's often not about you. So to me, the way I've always thought about luck is, yes, do a lot of different things, put myself in position to have serendipity hit. And then when serendipity hits, have the self-confidence to jump on it, you know, and then it does have a way of snowballing. Like, the more you do, the more you give, the more you put yourself out there, the more you just happen to be in the pathway of it and be able to take advantage of it.
We'll be right back with Jim Vandehei.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
And we're back with Jim Vondahai, co-founder and CEO of Axios. Something else that I wanted to talk to you about is job interviews. Something you wrote was basically that you look for people who have two things, which are ambition to be the best at what they do, but also humble enough to put the organization and the team ahead of themselves. Do you think that is something that applies to most companies? Do you think that's a success metric or success equation for most candidates?
I don't know how you could go wrong with it. Right. You want somebody, at the end of the day, it's capitalism. We want people who are exceptional at what they do, right, who have passion for what they do. And if you can find those people and they truly can put the company or the team above themselves, you know they're a good human. So like a good human who's really good at their job, it's gold. And I would take a room full of them to start a company, regardless of what their skill set was, than I would with people who have the right skill set, but they're not good people or they don't work well with other people or whatever else.
So if people who are walking into interviews and they want to sort of sell that idea of, listen, I'm going to try and be the best of the best in this area, but also I'm going to be a team player, how do you suggest they have that come across in the interview?
I think in any interview, like one, do your homework. I'm surprised how many people aren't intimately familiar with the company. And there's a little thing called Google. Google the person you're interviewing with. Learn something about them. Don't make it all about you. You know, anyone who keeps saying I in an interview tends to be someone you don't want to hire. And, you know, people who talk about we and how together we did this is something that I'm always looking for. Then just people who are dogging people in interviews, which happens more often than you think. Oh, I was doing well, but my boss was a jerk. Like, just it's just a big yellow or red flag. So come in. Understand the job, understand the company, understand the person you're interviewing with, and then be very authentic and conversational about like, listen, here's why I want to work for your company. Here's like why I believe in the mission. I believe in the work that you're doing. And listen, because I believe in the mission, like I'm a good colleague. Like I'm gonna go to war for the team, not just for myself. And then after that interview, follow up. Right. I'm always impressed by people who send a note quickly, not a week later, either a handwritten note, an email saying, listen, I appreciate your time to reiterate that I want this job. I want to work for you. Here's why. Here's what I bring to the table. Just let me know if there's anything else I could do. Love to keep this conversation going. And I think if you do those two things, you probably give yourself the best chance to be successful.
Yeah. And actually, you said the magic words, which is I want the job, because so many people, when they say they're struggling with their job search, I'll sometimes tell them, have you told them that you want the job? And they'll say that as soon as they sort of flip that script from playing hard to get to, hey, I actually do want this job, their luck tends to change and they start getting farther along in the hiring process.
As a person on the hiring side, like, it is not the flattery. You want to know somebody, I want to work at Axios. Man, I've heard great things about you. I've heard great things about your culture. Like, I was born to work for you. Like, I love when I hear that. Any employer wants to hear that. They want to know that the company that they work for, that you hold it in high esteem and that you would come in with this genuine passion and that you're going to, you know, chew glass to be successful for the company. I'm not saying be macho or too much bravado or any of that, but there's nothing wrong with being genuinely enthusiastic about a gig and being extremely clear about what you bring to the table. Like, I would, if I were interviewing, I would be very clear. Like, I'm not a great operator per se. I'm not great on the details, but on the things I'm good at, like, I'm going to probably outwork the person next to me, and I care a hell of a lot about the mission of the company, and therefore we're going to bring a lot of value.
Something that I want to talk to you about, too, is something in your book where you talk about quitting more. And something that I sometimes talk with people about is the idea about, you know, work is work, and they get into this idea that, you know, yeah, it's drudgery, it's monotonous, but that's work. And in your book, you were sort of saying, listen, that shouldn't be what your work is. And if it is, you should look for the exit. Can you tell us a little bit about your philosophy on that and also how you've applied it in your own life?
Yeah, I think, listen, if always with the asterisk of, listen, if you have to support a family or you have to support family members, like, you truly have obligation, this probably doesn't apply. But for most of us, for most of our life, we do have optionality, right? You were taught often, especially if you come from a smaller town or a more traditional background, that you just, a job's a job, or you have to stick with it for years. Our parents were wrong. Like, once upon a time, you actually had a pension, so you had an incentive to stay there longer. You don't have to. You should not be in a position where you don't like the job you're doing. Not for a week or two. We all have bad weeks or bad months. But if you're in something for 6 months and you're consistently unhappy, unmotivated, unsatisfied, and you have the option, get out. Don't feel that because you started a job, you have to stay there 5 years. There's nothing wrong with leaving a job that you hate or a boss that you hate after a year if it's not the right fit, or even less than a year. And it's not always easy, but the best example for me was, we had started Politico. There's a group of us had started it. It was very, very successful. But the guy who backed it, who was the owner of the company and had the majority share, and me, we just didn't agree in the end. Like, we just had different values, believed in how we treat people differently. And it made me unhappy. It meant like 70% of my time was suddenly dealing with tension. And I quit. I quit the job that the company that I founded. It was like my baby. Like, that was hard. And it was miserable for a couple months. But then on the other side of it, I started a company called Axios with people I love and people who share my values. And it's wonderful. Every day is like 95% stuff I enjoy doing. But it only happened because I quit.
Yeah. That leads me into sort of the last thing I want to talk to you about, which is the idea of risk. For people who aren't familiar with the media industry, it could be a dark and dreary place. And you've created, you know, Politico and Axios, which anyone who's been in that space, they are the most successful media startups probably within the past two decades, if not more. So how did you learn how to take risk and where to put your chips? Because you have a good track record in a very difficult area.
It's interesting because I wouldn't like look at my life as a whole and say I'm a big risk taker. I'm a big calculated risk taker, but I don't ever take like real risks. I was always a gambler. Like, I'd like to play cribbage for money. I like to play poker. And so I definitely learned a lot about risk, and risk with like anxiety mitigation, like knowing when to quit and how to kind of increase your odds. And so by the time we did Politico, which was the first big risk, that was 17 years ago, we started a company, I left a job, it could have flopped by all measures, like the chances were it would flop. But it, in my mind, wasn't actually a huge risk. It was a calculated risk, because my mindset at the time was, okay, even if I fail, so I leave the post, I start this company, let's say it fails miserably, I still knew that I was a really good reporter. And I knew somebody would hire me to cover Congress or the White House or politics. So it wasn't that risky. I had to risk public humiliation. But on that one, I have a very high risk tolerance. I would trace it to my parents, but I don't care what other people think of me. Like, I care desperately what my kids think of me and what my wife thinks of me and my parents. I just don't care what people in Washington think about me. And so the public humiliation part that would usually spook people, that didn't bother me at all. And by the time we did Axios, which is another risky endeavor, I'd already had one success. I was starting something with people I knew that were really, really good at what they do and better than me at the things that they do, and in a space that I was pretty familiar with. So it wasn't that risky. It's interesting. Like, risk is not that different than luck. It builds on itself, right? Like, it, little by little, if you take a risk and you're successful, then you kind of know how to position yourself to think through the pros and cons of the next risk. And you just get better at it. And that's an interesting thing, is like, for your listeners, as you get older, the older you get, the better this like natural intuition gets. Like, there's so many things now that come in front of me that I can instantly give an answer, and I'm 90% I'm going to be right. Whereas 30 years ago, 90% I would have been wrong or had no ability to even make an appraisal of it. And so a lot of that comes from putting yourself in these different places to feel luck or to take risk. And then the totality of that is that you're better at what you do and you're more confident in your actions.
Before I do let you go, is there anything else that, you know, for job seekers or people who's really trying to grow their career that you think is important to leave them with?
We control more than we think we control. And for me to be really good at work, I got to have my crap together at home. I've got to have my faith right. I've got to have my diet right. I've got to have the fun and connection part of my life right. I've got to have my friendships right. The work-life balance, like, I have no idea what that means. I just think of it as my life. And in my life, I want some balance. I want to be really good at what I do. I want to be a really good father. I want to be a really good husband. I want to be a really good son. I want to be faithful. There's a bunch of things that I want to be. And so I just think, be more methodical. Like, think about the things that matter to you. Think about the different buckets of life. And how can you, little by little, get better in all of those? And then they tend to work in concert to make you a better you.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That was Jim Vandehei, co-founder and CEO of Axios. If you're leaving today's conversation with a new learning to apply to your job search or career, I'd like to invite you to write about it in a review on Apple Podcast. Our team really enjoys reading what you learn from our shows. Plus, it helps other people discover our community. Speaking of community, remember that we're always here, backing you up and cheering you on. Connect with me, Andrew Seaman, and the Get Hired community on LinkedIn to continue the conversation. In fact, subscribe to my weekly newsletter that's called, you guessed it, Get Hired, to get even more information delivered to you every week. You can find those links in the show notes. And of course, don't forget to click the follow or subscribe button to get our podcast delivered to you every Wednesday, because we'll be continuing these conversations on the next episode, right here, wherever you like to listen. Get Hired is a production of LinkedIn News. This episode was produced by Alexis Ramdow. Grace Rubin is our associate producer. Asaf Gidron engineered our show. Joe DeGiorgi mixed our show. Dave Pond is head of news production. Enrique Montalvo is our executive producer. Courtney Koop is the head of original programming for LinkedIn. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. And I am Andrew Seaman. Until next time, stay well and best of luck.